Hello, and welcome to show number 2531 of Eyes on Success, a weekly program empowering the visually impaired with expert advice, personal stories, and the latest in technology and accessibility. I'm Nancy Goodman-Torpy.
And I'm Pete Torpy.
They tell me it's never snowing. I just never seem to get.
That was a short snippet from a tune written, performed, and produced by today's guest.
Music technology has changed drastically over the years, and today we will meet again with Park Peters for a tour of his home studio after our conversation on Zoom last week with him. We'll discuss the transition from analog equipment like tape decks to powerful digital tools that are more affordable and more accessible, as well as the wide array of gear that has shaped Park's path as an audio producer. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Park Peters.
From my perspective, computers have never been more accessible, while at the same time have never been less accessible than ever. But for the most part, things are more accessible. There are so many great websites. Some of the YouTube videos, you know, they'll say, well, click this and on. But if you can get past some of that, there are lots of good YouTube videos and resources from music theory all the way to MIDI programming. There are websites and discussion groups, some of which are for blind people, most of which are not, but there's just never been a greater amount of resources than there are right now.
Although we have come a long way with our access technologies, screen readers, etc., it does seem that occasionally we take two steps forward and one step backwards as the technology for the rest of the world advances. Sometimes it takes a while for our screen readers and other technologies to catch up. In general, I would agree that things are much more accessible than they used to be in the past when there were no screen readers, braille displays, etc. But, of course, there are always some challenges, and we learn to deal with them, fortunately.
And all of those advances in accessibility have definitely been a good thing.
Support for Eyes on Success is provided by
First Aid for the Blind, teaching blind and vision-impaired clients important life skills through live video training from blind instructors. The purpose of FAFTB's training is to replace the fear of the unknown with feelings of hope and confidence. More information is at FAFTB.com.
And by
Biped AI, the Swiss startup behind Noah, an all-in-one mobility tool worn on the shoulders. Noah provides audio GPS instructions, detects obstacles, and describes surroundings in real time using its live AI feature. More information is available at biped.ai.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
Let's start by reintroducing Park.
In last week's episode, we spoke with today's guest about his life and training and career as a blind musician and audio producer. And this week, we meet him in his studio in person. So, Park, for people who may not have heard that episode, why don't you remind us who you are and what you do, a little bit about yourself?
Well, my name is Park Peters. I have been a recording engineer, musician, producer for basically the last 47 years of my 66 years. I've been a professional musician a little bit longer than that. Basically, I've been working in the Denver metropolitan area, running a recording studio, which is a trick for someone who is blind, like myself. When I started out, there was nothing to accommodate someone who was blind in either the electronic or the recording field to speak of. So I kind of had to make my way. I had to teach myself how to solder. I had to figure out various ways that I could test electronic components if I wanted to work on anything. And so with all of those skills, with learning piano tuning and rebuilding Fender Rhodes electric pianos and being a musician and being an occasional recording engineer, I've managed to eke out a living and I'm still here.
Well, that's great. And you've certainly done well for yourself.
Eyes on Success connects corporate sponsors with visually impaired listeners around the world.
More information about becoming a sponsor can be found at www.sponsor.eyesonsuccess.net.
This week's focus topic is the tour of Park Peters Audio Production Studio that we were able to enjoy, and a discussion with him of some of the tools he's worked with over the past many years.
So when we came into your house, you invited us down to the basement where you keep the heart of your recording studio. And the first thing you pointed out to us was that it was hot down the basement, which isn't usually the case.
No.
Why was that?
Because of all the equipment I have down here. The biggest piece of which is a 96 input Otari mixing console, which itself has four power supplies. I also have a 2-inch 16-track machine, a 2-inch 24-track machine, a 1-inch 16-track machine, a 1/2-inch 8-track machine, and pretty much any format of reel-to-reel machine you can think of, and cassette machine that you can think of, stashed down here on top of all of the musical equipment that I have. And when it's all powered up, it, especially the mixing console, and then I have several computers that run everything. Between all of those, they generate some heat. They keep it kind of warm down here.
Just to give you an idea of this mixer, if you've ever been to a live concert, you may have, if you got permission to get close enough, seen a mixer like this. It's nearly as big as a ping pong table with 96 columns of, I don't know how many dozen knobs there are.
There's a lot of them.
There's a lot of knobs on this thing. And, oh, by the way, red, yellow, and green lights doing all sorts of stuff.
And Nancy noticed one item that did not have power. It was a Perkins Brailler.
I do have one. It's actually the same one that I got. In 1964, just as I was starting kindergarten. So I've had it a long time. And if anybody ever read my cryptic notes in Braille, well, you can't. If you don't understand my shorthand, you'll never make it through. So when somebody finds those after I'm gone, they're going to just end up throwing them away because they're indecipherable unless you know what it means. Like if I'm singing, one of the problems with recording is that moving your fingers across the paper can pick up on the microphone. So if it's repetitive information, I'll write as little as possible. The example that popped to mind was at one point I had a session where I was asked to sing the old jazz standard song, Watch What Happens. And in order to save space and not have to move my fingers so much, Watch What Happens, every time that appears, was just written WWH.
Oh, that's pretty clever. I've heard about people complaining that when they have a digital refreshable Braille display in the audio, you can sometimes hear the dots popping up and down also.
Yeah, I've never used one of those, so I don't have any. I've never had the money to get one. So, and nobody was willing to give me one.
You mentioned your mixing setup here with 96 sets of controls on it. I'm wondering how you manage all that. Do you do that by touch or some other magic method that lets you navigate around all those controls?
Counting is the best system that I've found. I've threatened to label it, but the cheater technique of this board is that everything on it is automatable. So once you've set channels 1 through 8, you don't have to touch them again. The faders don't move. They're not motorized. But once you get those levels the way you want them to be, you don't ever have to work with them unless you want to change something. And the other cheater's technique is that channels can be grouped. So, you know, if I'm mixing something with drums and the drums are across 12 channels, I can put them on one easily findable fader and say, the drums are here. The two most common that I use, I have an EMT plate reverb, which is a classic in itself. It's what pretty much all the records of the mid-50s through the early 70s, mid-70s used for reverb. It was one of three things, either an EMT plate, a room that would be built into a studio, or an AKG BX20 were the most common reverbs around. And I've got an EMT plate that I picked up from a studio going out of business. So it returns to two faders that I never move. They are at the top of the board. There are two faders per strip. So there's 48 strips. It's at the top strip. So those two became my most common group inputs because I would bypass the faders and leave the level to the EMT set. So I could use those for all the drums on one, all the background vocals on one. So it's not that hard to get around, you know, without having to count every little whip snitch.
As we were driving up, Nancy mentioned that there was a railroad passing close by.
Yep.
What do you do about noise reduction down here?
Wait for the train to go by.
So you're not doing anything live. You can just wait and not have to worry about anything getting wrecked.
Right. Although there are many good plugins. There's a Supertone Clear, which is pretty good. There are some Waves plugins that are pretty good. There's just good old equalization, which I've had to use once in a while. But the best form of noise reduction is to not record it in the first place.
But you do record in the house here, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't see any playable musical instruments down here.
They're in another room.
Okay.
I've got two other rooms. One is kind of an isolated little room where I can do vocals and that sort of thing. So if I have somebody in, I can put them in there and I can be listening out here.
And it doesn't matter that you can't see from one room to the other because
no.
It doesn't change anything.
Along the way, I had a full functioning studio with three control rooms, and those did have windows so that you could see what was on the other side. The biggest thing that I noticed was that when there was a window, people would walk up to the window and talk to me. Would you please grab a microphone? I can hear you better if you do that. You know,
it's hard to lip read for a blind person.
It is. It is.
On our way from the front door to the recording studio, we passed some very interesting looking pianos.
There is in our little foyer, there is an upright piano that was Peggy's great aunt's. It's got more sentimental value than anything else, although it's a good piano. It's a good quality piano. And we also have a pump organ that I inherited from my mom when she passed. Actually, I helped her get it. A client of mine called me up and said, Park, you need a pump organ in your studio. And I said, no, I don't. But my mom wants one. He called my mom and she said, oh, yes, I'd love it. So then when she passed, I got it. So karma being what it is, it's in my studio, sort of.
Does anybody play it?
I play it sometimes, yeah. I've used it on a few little things to be, you know, Beatlesque, similar sounding to an accordion when all is said and done, but it's kind of fun. It's you get your exercise when you play a pump organ, because if you stop pumping, it stops playing.
What other instruments do you play?
I used to play guitar, but in October of 2021, I fell when I was outside. And ended up getting 22 stitches in my left index finger. And I can't bend it quite well enough anymore to play chords on a guitar. Unless I switch hands, I guess I could learn it that way. But I haven't. So it doesn't really affect my keyboard playing at all. And I've got all the engineering things. So it's kind of let guitar playing go.
And what other instruments do you enjoy playing?
I used to play guitar. I used to play bass. I've dabbled with playing drums, keyboards and vocals.
So this has been such an interesting conversation. And we're sitting here surrounded by electronics and recording equipment, some of which looks brand new and some of which, frankly, is kind of vintage.
Yes.
What are some of your most interesting devices down here?
Well, I have, and I still use from time to time, an old modular Moog that was built, actually it was owned by Robert Moog. It's got his social security number inside, which I won't divulge to you. but it was made in 1969. And gosh, I modified my mini Moog so that I can slave the two to each other back in the days of analog synthesis. You know, MIDI didn't exist at that point. I have a lot of MIDI gear in the other room, a lot of keyboards and dedicated hardware. More and more, I'm doing it all in the computer, and I'm not using the hardware much, other than you need a keyboard to play stuff in. And then I have a 1948 Hammond, was a C2, and I've paid somebody to bring it up to be a C3. And then I've got a Leslie speaker to go with that, and a straight Hammond tone cabinet as well, which I'm kind of proud of. I'm not a great jazz Hammond player, but it sure is a nice touch to be able to add it to records, especially if it's, you know, kind of more rock-oriented. There's just nothing that sounds like a Hammond.
So you produce a lot of music. You also write your own music, right?
I do.
Tell us a little about that.
I can actually remember the first song I wrote when I was like 4. It was right around this time of year, right around the 4th of July. I was out on the swing set, and somebody was shooting off firecrackers, and I wrote this little ditty that went, "Are you ready? Are you ready for a boom? For a boom? Are you ready? Are you ready for a boom? For a boom? Are you ready for a boom? Are you ready? Are you ready for a boom? For a boom?" You know, they don't get any dumber than that.
Oh, come on. It's adorable. And for a 4-year-old, it's remarkable.
So, you know, that was my first song, and probably the first, I don't know, 40 or 50 that I wrote are quite suitable for burning, just like that one. But eventually, by the time I was, I don't know, 10, 11, 12, some of them started getting halfway good. And so I started learning how to record myself and, you know, got other musicians to play with me. And by the time I was about 14, 15, I actually got called up to play a gig at a studio. And I, you know, of course said, yeah, I'll do that. So, you know, it's just kind of been some meandering path, but it's been the path that's just kind of appeared in front of me.
So you've been doing this work for a really long time. How many albums do you figure you've produced?
I've lost count of how many albums I've produced for people over the years. I think at this point I've produced 9 of my own albums. The first album that came out on vinyl was a Dixieland band that I recorded in 1979. So I've been lucky enough to work on album projects throughout the years. And now vinyl is coming back, so.
Are you still playing with other musicians these days?
Yeah, sometimes, if the opportunity presents itself, yeah. Sometimes that occurs here, and sometimes, you know, I'll go out and play gigs, either solo or with other people. I don't play gigs like I did 30 years ago. You know, I'm not playing 4 nights a week or anything like that. I actually played a gig one time where the drummer fell asleep.
Oops.
During the set. We're just playing along and time starts getting a little wonky, and then he just fell over his drum set and knocked over one of the cymbals. So, yeah, I'm not playing gigs like I used to, mostly because I don't like hauling the equipment around.
Pete used to play with a trio, and he played piano, and the other mm-hmm. 2 guys, one played guitar and the other one electric bass, and so they always had a ton of equipment, and if we were lucky, the venue had a piano.
Right, then you don't have to move keyboards.
Because I, in addition to everything else, was his roadie and his groupie.
Right.
But every once in a while, they did not have a piano, and we'd have to haul the piano.
Right.
Which even an electric piano in a case is bigger than either of us, plus the amp, plus the seat, plus the stand, plus the equipment. And it was horrible.
The first time I went on the road as a musician was in the late 70s. And my rig was a Fender Rhodes suitcase, electric piano, two synthesizers which sat on top of it, and one of the horn players had a Hammond B3 organ with two Leslies, and I had a string machine that sat on top of that. And I was running the sound, you know, I was running the PA. So it took us a while to set up for those gigs.
So speaking of digital, tell us a little bit about how things have changed from the analog world to a lot of your work being done digitally these days.
Where to begin? I mean, I've kind of watched the transition take place. Back in the 90s, I had a studio in my house up until 1992, and then I moved into a commercial location at that point. And digital recording was pretty well established by then, but it wasn't cheap. I got a digital rig that would let me edit two tracks at a time, and I still use that software or a version of it, a later version of it, even still if I need to do something quick and dirty. But it would edit two tracks, and the hard drive itself was $3,000. The computer was about $3,000. And the high-quality interface with the digital ins and outs as well as analog was another roughly $3,000. And one of the biggest marketing mistakes that I made was not marketing that ability. I just figured I was the last guy on the block to get digital editing at that point. And in fact, I certainly wasn't the first, but there were a lot of studios that couldn't edit their own masters, I discovered. So for a couple of years, I got a lot of business. Just they'd bring the DAT tape over, and we'd play it into the computer, and I would edit it, you know, and make a CD master of it.
And what's a DAT?
It stands for digital audio tape. They're little bitty cassettes that are about 2 inches by 3 inches. They're very similar to, innards are very similar to a VHS videotape. The unit has a rotating head that plays the tape, and because of that, they're just as fragile as VHS tapes, if not more so, because they're really small. But I still have a machine that will play them, and I still get work coming in for people that have tapes that need to get them transferred, so I'm still using it.
And speaking of how the costs have come down, you and I kind of met on a Reaper forum. Reaper is a software that audio producers use for editing and producing music, and that costs about $60 these days.
Yeah, I got the full commercial license, which ran me more like $200. But still, the first system I ever got a chance to work with was in Salt Lake City, and it was run by a company called Soundstream. At that time, they sent a crew and a digital recorder to where they wanted something recorded, and they brought it back to Salt Lake City to edit on a deck mainframe. That was in the late 70s. That system was still in use. Actually, one of the guys called me in 1991 and offered to sell me, or give to me, basically, a deck mainframe and one of their terminals. Which I don't know where I would have put it.
You might have needed a bigger house.
I might have needed a bigger house. But within a year of that happening, I bought the digital editing system that was basically running on a souped-up 386. So the technology was there where one person could do it themselves and have the gear right there.
It's really incredible how technology has changed over the years.
Yeah, it's just amazing. You know, I mean, to realize that we put a man on the moon with a computer with 32K of memory. That's 32 kilobytes of memory, 32,000 bytes, and a 1 megahertz clock. My phone has more than that, and it's got a million times more than that, and it's 9 years old. It's just crazy.
How things have changed and enabled you to do what you do down your basement here in your own house.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was certainly a fascinating tour through a lot of history. Thanks a lot for the opportunity to see your studio.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
Now for this week's final item, how to learn more about Park Peters' experience in music performance and production, and how to contact him.
Well, Park, this was a great conversation, an opportunity to see your setup down here. And I was wondering if people have questions for you, how could they contact you or listen to some of your albums, etc.?
I am working on putting together a website currently. I don't have one. I had one for a long time, and the company went out of business, so that's forthcoming. The best ways to get in touch with me at this point are either through email, which is audioparkrecording, no S at the end, just audioparkrecording, one big long word, at gmail.com. Or I've got a phone number. If I miss a session and can't answer it, I don't pick it up. It's 303-456-6122. Gets you in touch with either me or my voicemail. And, you know, if somebody's interested in whatever, I'm happy to talk to people.
Are there any resources that you would recommend people start with if they're thinking of getting into music production blind?
Pick another profession. No.
Oh my gosh, it took me a second to figure out what you were saying. Oh man. Well, it's worked for you. You both have made a lot of use of Reaper. Are there good resources to help blind people use that?
One of the best resources that I've found recently is, within the last 3 years or so, is the Reapers Without Peepers group.
Which is how we met.
Yeah. It's a worldwide community. And there's people all over. There's people in Germany. The guy that runs it is in England. There's people in Sweden, Norway, United States, Canada, Africa. It's all over the map. So it kind of reminds me of when I had my ham radio license back in this early 70s. You just never know who you're going to talk to. It's a great resource for music. There are a couple of groups for MIDI things.
And we'll have more information in the show notes on how to subscribe to the Reaper Forum and some additional resources. Just activate the links to the show notes for episode 2531, and you'll find all of that.
That's it for today's show. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about tactile cubing. How would you solve a Rubik's Cube if you were blind? We'll talk with Paul Martz, author of the book Solve It, the only speed-solving guide for blind cubers. Paul, who is blind, describes how he uses textures, memory skills, and blazing speed to participate in timed challenges against blind and sighted participants.
We hope you all enjoyed our tour of Park's studio as much as we did this week, and we hope to see you again next week.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
You can access the full archive of previous shows, subscribe to the podcast, and much more by going to our website, www.eyesonsuccess.net. If you have questions about anything you've heard on the show or have suggestions for future shows, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net.
Thank you for listening and have a nice day.